Well, it's my pleasure to be here this afternoon. I'm going to get right into it if I can. Am I doing it wrong?
Yeah,
okay.
No.
We did have to do our disclosure, so I'm going to do a quick disclosure that I am presently being paid through ADA as a stipend for this presentation as a member of the Evidence Analysis Library, Health Disparities Expert Work Group. And I also have funding from the City of Milwaukee Health Department and the Milwaukee County Nutrition and Physical Activity Coalition. We call it MAC and PAC for short. And then no other financial input has been made for this conference. This is what you will see. Now, I will have to let you know that my talk is a talk from the work that I've been doing with the American Dietetic Association Health Disparities Library analysis for what dietitians can do to eliminate health disparities. This is the homepage of the Evidence Analysis Library. You do have a handout that I gave out, and there should be some at the end of the room if you didn't receive it. But this is just letting everyone know that although this is primarily started for ADA members, anybody can have a subscription to the Evidence Analysis Library, and it is actually being used all over the world. And since I last talked, they have now increased 2 more million inputs to that site. So it's very well used and recognized. And I do want to say one last thing about the American Dietetic Association is that you know that the name will be now changed in January to be the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics. So the Evidence-Based Analysis Library will still be there, but it just will be under a different name. Nope, wrong way. So what is evidence-based practice? It's systematically review of scientific evidence and making nutrition and food and nutrition practice decisions, but also the integration of the best available evidence with your professional expertise and the client's values to improve outcomes. So when we start looking at evidence-based data, we are looking at really trying to develop a quality healthcare practice to eliminate wide variations in practice. If enough practitioners actually embrace using evidence-based practice, we should be able to cut down the differences in outcomes and actually have better outcomes for all. The other thing is we are looking at reducing the gaps of knowledge from what we know in research to what actually works in the real world. And then also looking at taking advantage of new biomedical knowledge that is learned. In 2008, there was a call to action, and that call to action from the Evidence-Based Practice Committee actually went out to all dietitians all over the country because we really looked at health disparities as something that each and everyone can put into their own practice. This is the work group that was developed, and we had some work group members like Diane Longstreet, who started out in Australia. So we actually had a number of people all over the country that came together to look at how can the practice of dietetics actually help to eliminate health disparities. In looking at the steps of an evidence analysis process, keep in mind that the new 2010 dietary guidelines actually use this type of a process in formulating the new guidelines. And the process really starts with formulation of questions. We had so many questions that we just brainstormed and throwed out of what we would like to find out as far as what actually is out there related to health disparities that dietitians can grab hold of. We also looked at the next step of gathering the research, and we did set some parameters, and I'll show you those in a minute. But we also wanted to make sure that we searched out all types of different articles from all different areas, and so that was a critical process. In step 3, we actually critically appraised each article. We divided up each articles, and many times we are having 50, 60 articles for each subject matter to go through and really look at, does it meet and answer the question? So we have some articles that are considered inclusion articles, some articles that are exclusion articles. All the articles used in evaluating this whole process is available on the Evidence Analysis Library, so that it actually coalesces many of those articles into one place. And then we summarize the evidence that gets it to be the inclusion factor. So there are evidence tables and evidence summaries of all of the data that has been included for each one of the questions that have been answered. But then we also, as a group, for each question, there may be 5 to 10, 14 articles that are included. We then do a conclusion of all of those articles combined and then evaluate and give a grade to the strength of the evidence based on research processes. These are the limits that were set for this particular evidence analysis. And in the library, you have multitude of other evidence analysis from cardiovascular to childhood obesity that's there. So we looked at U.S. population. That was a big deal because we were really trying to say, what can we realistically do in a certain amount of time? And we knew that we could not tackle disparities worldwide, that we really wanted to really, first of all, do our first analysis on the U.S. population. Mostly adults, however, we did include teens, pregnant teens, and children when we looked at those areas, because we felt like to leave teens out of pregnancy would not cover the whole picture, nor would food insecurity if you let your children and seniors out of that picture. The other thing is we had so many conditions that we wanted to cover at first, but we narrowed it down to 4 conditions because we wanted to make sure that some of the ones that are what we call hot topics at this time, that we give individuals that information first before we go on to other topics. So we included diabetes, cardiovascular disease, obesity, and pregnancy, breastfeeding as a group. We also wanted to make sure that we looked at different ethnic groups, racial ethnic groups, and then it says, but we looked at all food insecure. So we looked at particularly these ethnic groups, but yet we in the food secure, we didn't really signal out different groups. Socioeconomic groups, we looked at the insured, uninsured, income, poverty level. We looked at geographic areas, but we also said for this particular research, we wanted to use research from all health professionals. When we started looking at the research that was done in the nutrition and food area, to exclude any one group, the number of sites became very, very small. So that really says that there is room for lots more research to be done by all. So in this, what I'm going to do today is just summarize some of the evidence, showcase a few examples, and then also look at the conclusion statements. My goal is to make sure I go through all of the conclusion statements, so I'm going to try to keep going. When we looked at the conclusion statements, I said we gave a grade, but the nutrition intervention methods and nutrition methods or characteristics, those were the first group. There's other things that is in the library, which what professionals were used, what locations were most effective. So there's other things in there that I'm not going to report on for sake of time. So this is our first question. Access to care. What evidence demonstrates that access to nutrition and dietetic services and educational resources among health disparate population differs based on socioeconomic status, racial ethnic groups, and geographic location? That difference became very important. At first, we were pulling out articles that shows that nutrition makes a difference, that it makes a difference. Now, just think of how many outcome studies and things that we're seeing that it makes a difference. But that wasn't the question that we really wanted to know. We wanted to know, was there a difference in access? And with that, then, we only found 2 cross-sectional studies that actually showed that there was a total difference in access to nutrition information. So we gave it a grade level 3, a very limited. People assume that there's a lack of access, but the data is not really showing that it's been demonstrated that there's a lack of access. This one study is the one I was going to showcase, and this is one of the way that the evidence summaries are stated. It talks about a study in teaching hospitals across the United States that found that minority patients who had congestive heart failure was receiving less congestive heart failure discharge counseling than non-minority clients. And the total conclusion of this study was that there was a major difference in the quality of the care and then the education that was given, but they concluded that it was mostly because of the site where minorities seek health care, meaning that there are certain hospitals that take more uninsured or underinsured patients. They have a higher volume of patients. They may not have enough staffing to cover the number of patients that are coming through, and they may have less reimbursement from funding sources. So they were thinking if all things was equal, that they had all the money, all the staff, all the things that they would need, that then this would disappear. However, when they actually control for that difference and they took that factor out, they still saw a difference in services that were provided, still existing after controlling for those sites. So that this was one definitive one that did show that there was a difference in services provided to minority populations. Wrong way. Our next question involved cross-cultural communications. We looked at what elements of cross-cultural communications enhance the effectiveness of nutrition assessment or intervention. Big thing was we had to define, because we were from all different parts of the country and we all had a different idea of what cross-cultural communication means. We did have to develop a definition, but we also wanted to make sure that definition was inclusive to make sure we looked at verbal, nonverbal context, and the cultural context of the individual. And that was important because at one time I did not quite understand that certain people use many, many words and many descriptions of events around them to get meaning. Like I'm using my hands and I keep bumping into this thing right here. It's hard for me to be still. The other people may use just real clear words. And I know some people are probably really versed in context, but I just wanted to bring that out because I have a, my daughter, she is one of the ones that have a high context. And even for me, it's hard for me to listen to her when I say she's trying to tell me something. She said, well, let me tell you this. It's, you know, I had to talk to a friend of mine yesterday. Blah, blah, blah. I said, well, what that has to do with what? I'm trying to get to it. And so the people that have to give you that background, it really kind of gets on other people's nerves to say, why don't they get to the point? Why do I have to hear all this? So that's what context is, and I don't want to labor on it, but some people, in order for them to get their message across, they talk in stories and parables and stuff, while other people really need the words. And if you're working with different people, that will either help you or not help you. I had staff at one time that were both ways, and then I'm wordy, so I had to learn. They don't like that. You need to get to the point. So let me get to the point. These are the studies. There was only 4 major studies that met the criteria of answering that question. And as you can see, I made sure I included the types, 2 randomized control trial, 1 prospective cohort study, and 1 cross-sectional. The strength of those studies are great. However, there's only 4 of them. So if we were looking at that grade level, we only gave it a fair. We did find that there were bilingual and nurses that when they have those, that they actually increased the effectiveness. Persons in the community as community health workers at one time, and you'll see in the future, it was brought up to promotoras, very effective. Focus groups to develop She's giving me the time. I'm going to be going faster. But focus group to develop programs, telephonic technology. Using the telephone is something that was clearly involved in many different studies. This is question three. Question three looked at the types of intervention methods that have been shown to improve nutrition outcomes. We wanted to have just outcomes, but we had to break it down because it was just sometimes a different for each different group. So we looked at four different groups: breastfeeding women, adult with diabetes, overweight, obesity, and cardiovascular disease. You see that for the breastfeeding, you had a good. We had 12 studies. And we have many different areas at the characteristics, but looking at the third one down, the advocacy by community coalitions, they found having a community context to breastfeeding and breastfeeding support was very, very effective in increasing breastfeeding rates and duration. Communication tools and such as video technologies, telephone follow-ups, and written information was also very key. Again, diabetes, 12 studies are very good, and 7 randomized control trials is very, very good. Many things were the same, and I'm just going to point out we still had advocacy, but transportation becoming an issue, skills training, retention, and recruitment and retention into programs was very key. We looked at obesity, 6 studies. It wasn't quite as many, but there was 5 randomized controlled trials, so it still was very good data. And here I want to point out that enhancing access to fruits and vegetables, gyms, facility, enhancing access was a very key finding. And cardiovascular, you had your 7 studies. Randomized clinical trials was great. There, the DASH diet approaches actually really panned out good for various different ethnic groups. And so using that as a model would have been very, very key. Here we had for the food insecurity and access, there was several things and several questions. I'm not going to be able to go through all of them because of the timeline. But as you can see, one of them in the middle was different, and that's access to supermarkets. That was very, very important, and there was some key things, and I'm going to go straight to that one, because that one was different. It looked at we looked at community support and advocacy as being very strong. Getting your political leaders at the highest level involved in that was very important. And then also looking at maybe doing some different financial strategies. The last one on there was development and ownership of retail facilities by community development corporations. That's different. You know, actually the community purchasing the facility and then leasing it to the operator so you can control the types of foods that are available in the community. I'm going to skip. So the last conclusion then would be there's still more evidence analysis that needs to be done. There's several questions that have not been answered. One of one was, is there a difference in interpretation of biomedical lab values for different ethnic populations that's going to determine their nutritional status? We don't know if there's really a true difference. There's more documentation of innovative programs. We're hearing innovative programs all the time. Sometimes they don't get really documented and written up and shared and put into research. But then there's a huge practice-based research to make sure that you have sufficient quality. We put a lot of exclusion things in programs that just didn't have the rigor enough to be included. The last question I have for you is, how can we as health professionals, associations, and individuals assure that evidence-based practice that is identified get widely disseminated and incorporated in practice so we do have the best ways of eliminating health disparities with effective programs and outcomes? Thank you.
Thank you.